I know we'll go ahead and pick up where we left off last week in Hebrews chapter 12. And we didn't get too terribly far into the chapter, but at the same time, we're moving at about the pace that I intended. I say that as I don't want anyone to hold back any comments or questions thinking that we're not going to get through the material. I'm pretty sure we're going to get all the way through the chapter today with allowing time for comments or questions. So if you have something to add, just raise your hand or I'll pause a couple times to allow people to interject. Now, by way of a quick summary, last week we talked about how Hebrews chapter 11 really serves as a support for Hebrews chapter 12 by establishing, one, what can be accomplished by those basically who displayed faith in chapter 11. Two, it's there to show the readers that the individuals in chapter 11 suffered both in terms of persecution and hardship. And we didn't get really too much into this last week, but they also would have had to deal with discipline from the Lord. That's something that it seems as if the readers may have struggled to accept or at least forgotten in some ways, but that would have been typical, obviously, for those individuals as well. And then three, it showed that now that they and we have Christ, they and we should be able to accomplish more in the Lord. We should be able to do more and persevere more than those individuals mentioned in chapter 11. We then had a chance to take a look at the first few verses. Verse 1 there, we talked about the race of faith and how, just like with a real race, this is trying to kind of bring forth the ideal of that our race of faith too requires preparation, discipline, and perseverance. Yet with the perfect example of Christ that we have and the fact that in many ways he paved the road for us, we again should be able to accomplish more now with Christ. We then looked at verses 3 and 4 with, again, that dealing with the idea of persecution and with the fact that, again, we have Christ as the perfect example. Verse 5 then shifted gears a little bit and started dealing with the topic of discipline, and that's where we're going to pick up today. But really, last week, we looked at the first half, or we looked at verse 5 and the first half of verse 6. And with the topic of discipline, I mentioned last week that it's a topic that when it comes to the Lord disciplining his believers in Christ, it's something I just hadn't given a lot of thought to personally. I don't know if it's something we spend a lot of time talking about. We're obviously familiar with all the instances in the Old Testament where the Lord disciplined his believers back then. That was, you know, fairly commonplace throughout the Old Testament. But in terms of persecution of those in Christ, that's something, again, I don't think we spend a lot of time thinking about, and that's something that it seems the readers struggled with as well, as that seems to be a bit of a foreign topic to them. We then took a look at the first half of chapter 6, which discussed the idea of the attitude that we should have as we accept or try to accept discipline from the Lord. And we talked about how, really, if we look to what we want from earthly children in terms of accepting discipline, we can see a good model there with the idea that with children, we strive to have them understand the discipline. We strive to have them look to do better and to improve upon whatever they did wrong, that we want there to be that sense of guilt. And really, ultimately, that's how we should approach discipline from the Lord, that we should recognize that it's heavenly, we should recognize that it is for our own benefit, and we should strive to overcome whatever sin is holding us back. Moving on then to some new material now, we'll go ahead and pick up in verse 6. And really, we've already covered the first half of that. The second half of that reads, "For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives." Now, I talked a bit about this last week, the idea of with earthly children and with my daughter Hazel. And ultimately, same with any parent, that I discipline her because I love her. I'm striving to raise her in a way to keep her safe, to raise her in a way that would please the Lord, and try to get her to a point where she comes to know and love the Lord as well. And that ultimately, I think as any parent knows, there's corrective action that you need to take to try to ensure that. There's discipline that comes into play. But if those are the way, if that's the way that we feel, that's the way I feel as an earthly father for her, how much more must the Lord feel that way? It's a little difficult for us to conceptualize, but obviously if we feel that way about our children, the Lord must feel that way even more so, wanting to correct us, wanting to show us the right way. And we'll get into this later on as there's another verse that deals with this a little more directly, but even though with our children, I know there comes a time where we can't discipline them anymore and that they're kind of on their own, the Lord has that ability to correct us throughout our entire time here on this earth. Moving on then to verses 7 and 8, those read, "If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons." Now here the reader starts kind of shifting away from the idea of the mindset that they should have towards discipline, towards just the fact that you know, this is going to be something they're going to deal with. And now he's addressing the fact that they're going to see a difference between the discipline they're going to receive from the Lord and what those in the world around them, what they're going to see them having to deal with. And again, I think this comes back to, and this is a theme I think all throughout Hebrews chapter 12, the idea of getting their expectations right. We didn't get too much into this, but the entire chapter, or excuse me, the entire book really, is about showing the superiority of Christ and Christianity to what they're coming from. But at the same time, if all he was to talk about was the advantages, all the ways that it's superior, but never address the fact that there's going to be additional hardships, I think that would potentially set them up for, you know, a bit of a stumble there. And so much of this chapter is that idea of setting expectations, addressing the fact that they are going to suffer, they are going to deal with discipline from the Lord. And that's really what these verses here are about. And he's really trying to get them to see the fact that when it comes to sinful behavior here on this earth, that they're going to experience different things than non-believers. And there are some earthly sins that there are going to be earthly consequences for. We touched on this a little bit last week, the fact that there are earthly sins that no matter who it is who commits it, that there's a chance they're going to have to deal with earthly consequences for that. I think that probably the best example of that is with sexual immorality, that there are certain consequences to that. That doesn't matter if you're a believer or a non-believer, you may have to face that. But in terms of just discipline from the Lord, the passage here makes it clear that that is something that non-believers aren't going to have to deal with. And you could understand how for the readers that may be a difficult thing to accept, especially if they're coming from a place where before they were guilty of certain behaviors and they were not receiving discipline from the Lord, and now with those same behaviors they are as Christians, you can see how that may cause them to stumble. That may cause them to wonder what is going on. And if you went from a place in your life where you were not having to deal with that discipline from the Lord, you weren't having to deal with those hardships, but now you were, you may understand or you may see how that may cause you to question your decision to accept Christ. But again, comes back to that idea of trying to reframe their minds and get them to understand that why with their former lives they weren't experiencing those things and now that they are. And part of that, I think, comes back to the idea of, again, looking at chapter 11, looking at their past and getting them to see that not only is the history of the Jews and the history of those who followed the Lord one of suffering and persecution, but it's one of discipline. And like I mentioned before, all throughout the Old Testament, we see the hand of the Lord disciplining the children of Israel, trying to get them on the right path. But it seems, again, just how these individuals in their time weren't having to deal with persecution or suffering for the Lord as much as those in the past, it does seem here the fact that given that the Lord's hand was probably, from what we gather, not as heavy on the children of Israel as it once was, that this is something they seemingly have forgotten. And the author is striving to get them to see that they have made the right decision when it comes to accepting Christ into their lives. And that discipline that they're receiving isn't indicative of making a bad decision with Christ, but rather making a bad decision when it comes to sin. Now, I know I've been talking for a bit, and before we conclude this particular section with verses 9 through 11, I did want to pause and see if anyone had any comments or questions. Shane, or wherever you want to go, Bill. I don't know about that.
Just verse 11 there kind of hits home a little bit where the chastening, the punishment, the correction, it's not fun when it's happening, but you see the value of it after. So there's no substitute for time in some of this. And so as you're living it, as we're living it, as they're living it, you know, you may think, what in the world's going on? And so the writer here is encouraging the audience there that there's a reason behind this and God hasn't forgotten you.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that. And yeah, we'll be getting a chapter or verse 11 here in just a second. And yeah, that's, I think, certainly a big part of that. So appreciate that. Gerald?
Joey, that emphasis you made on the comparison between our earthly families and the way that God disciplines us, I think is a very important one. I believe it's why God created families, the family, and the way in which our children are born and raised so that we will understand that relationship that God has with us. We experience it. All of us have been born. All of us have been in a family of some type or another and can understand that relationship. And we can see beyond the now to the future.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look back on the discipline that our parents have given us, we can see the advantage that that gave us. We can see that we're better off that we endured that. And there's all types of discipline that God has put into this world. There's natural consequences that you mentioned. There are supernatural consequences that God exacted on the church. We don't have to look any further than 1 Corinthians 11th chapter to see that God caused something there for the good of that congregation and those people. Our task is not to question it, but to embrace it and look for the good that can come from it.
No, I appreciate that. And yeah, I know getting here a little farther, especially as Shane alluded to, verses 10 and 11 really gets into what it benefits us. So appreciate that comment, and we'll touch on that here more in just a second. All right, well, going ahead and moving on then. We'll read verses 9 through 11. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father as spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us, as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now again, considering that idea of earthly parents, obviously even with pure intentions, no parent can be perfect. I know one of the things that I guess I just didn't realize was going to be the case before I became a parent was, especially parenting a young child, just how so much of that job is just dealing with a million little decisions you have to make throughout the day. How are you going to address this behavior? How are you going to communicate this point? What are you going to do about this? And it's one of those things that I just wasn't quite ready for in some ways. And through that, through having to make all those decisions just on a daily basis, you're going to make mistakes. I know there's times where, you know, I do something and I think that, you know, maybe I missed the mark there, or maybe I missed a good teaching opportunity, or I wish that I had gone about something different, you know, when it comes to discipline. But in many ways, that's just the reality of being an earthly parent. And that doesn't even address the fact that there's many parents who don't always do those things with the purest of intentions. Parents who oftentimes discipline from a place of pure anger, pure emotion, who, you know, lash out irresponsibly or lash out inconsistently, and that can be difficult for a child. But nevertheless, even though I think that's somewhat what these passages are alluding to, parents who don't always have the purest of intentions, it says here that we paid them respect. I know as a child growing up, I had no concept that my parents weren't perfect in the decisions that they made. Just like now, I don't know if Hazel truly understands how often I don't know what I'm doing. And regardless of that, you know, with my parents, I accepted their rules, I accepted their discipline, and we just kind of moved on. And at the same time, they weren't perfect, nor could they be, just like I can't be perfect. Now here in verse 9, I know the King James renders earthly fathers as fleshly fathers, and I actually prefer that translation because I think it really demonstrates what we're talking about here and this comparison. On one hand, we have our fleshly fathers, who in part created us in the flesh. And on the other hand, when they are subjected to fleshly weaknesses. And on the other hand, we have our spiritual father, who is in heaven and is perfect. Or as it says here, the father of spirits. Now that phrase, father of spirits, is similar to what we read in Numbers 16 and 22. That is where, and I won't read that for the sake of time, but that's where Moses and Aaron are dealing with Korah's rebellion. And there the Lord says that he's going to basically destroy the children of Israel. And Moses and Aaron approach him and address him as the father of the spirits of all flesh. And that's similar phrasing here. It's not identical, but I think it's interesting that both of these instances use similar language, and both are dealing with the idea of discipline. On one hand, obviously, it's a bit more severe as the Lord was looking to destroy the children of Israel for what they were doing, but I think it's interesting that in both instances, we're talking about discipline, but we're also talking about the idea of spiritual possession. Just like with my daughter, she's my daughter because I helped create her here on this world. The Lord views us as his children because he spiritually created us. And through being our spiritual father, rather than a fleshly one, the Lord obviously isn't subject to the same fleshly weaknesses, but is perfect. And rather than discipline that's primarily focused on the flesh, both in terms of the discipline itself as well as what behavior it's trying to correct, our father's discipline is spiritual in nature. It's perfect. And as it says here in verse 10, it's designed to make us partakers of his holiness. And again, like I said before, this isn't something that just goes on for a time, but rather exists throughout our entire time here on this earth. I know verse 10 refers to that childhood symbolically as a few days, and that's just a pretty dramatic comparison, the fact that we can know and we can benefit from the discipline from the Lord our entire time here that we are believers. Now, wrapping up with verse 11, we again get the sense of how difficult this would have been. As Shane pointed out earlier, he's pointing out to them that this discipline isn't joyful in the present. And for them, I get the sense that this was their present. He was speaking to them on what they're experiencing right now. And I do think about how much that contrasts with so many modern-day false doctrines. The idea that the life of a Christian is going to be easy, the life of a Christian is going to be one without want. And here we see, point blank, he's saying that you're going to deal with hardship, not just in terms of persecution and struggles, as so much of this chapter has talked about, but you're going to deal with discipline from the Lord. And it says here, though, if we yield, that it will yield the peaceable fruit of righteousness. And I think Gerald alluded to this earlier, and I think that idea of peace is so perfect here, and especially when we consider it again in the context of earthly children. When a child places their trust in their parents, when those parents earn that trust, there is peace there. That child has the peace of knowing that their needs are going to be met, and that even if they face discipline from their parents, that it's being done for their own good. It's not being done just to be cruel or just because of frustration or anger, but rather it's done for their betterment. And there's peace with that. Just in that sense, when we accept discipline from the Lord, it will yield, as it says here, righteousness through correction, but also peace in the sense that we know we have a Father who loves us, who cares for us, and throughout our entire time here on this earth is going to provide that discipline to steer us in the right direction. And for me, I think of when I first came to Christ, when I went through the waters of baptism. It's been probably around 12 years now. There's a lot of things that changed in my life, but there's a lot of things that didn't. There's a lot of behaviors and things that I did before I became a Christian and I was doing after. I had many of the same friends and many of the same types of friends, and eventually that led to friction. Friction in the sense that I saw that I wasn't able to be the man that I knew I needed to be, the servant of God that I needed to be, but also friction in the sense that many of those friends who knew me before and many of those same types of friends that I made questioned my decisions. They wondered what I was doing and, spending all my time dedicated to the Lord, and that led to conflict. That led to them questioning me and mocking me, and at many times led to a bit of hostility. And I look back on that because as I've changed those behaviors and as I've moved away from many of those friends, I don't deal with that hostility in a way that I used to. There's still many people on a daily basis that I interact with who aren't believers. I deal with my family who aren't believers. And in that sense, though, I just don't deal with that same level of hostility. And I believe that's because back when I was not doing the things that I should have been doing, when I was not with the people that I should have been, I believe that was the hand of the Lord providing that discipline. And I think if we look carefully on our own lives, we can see the hand of the Lord in similar situations. That's my experience. And I know before we move on from this topic of discipline, I did want to pause again for any comments or questions anyone may have. All right. Well, moving on then, I know we'll start moving a little quicker through the passages now as really the ideas and concepts start covering bigger chunks, so we'll start moving faster here, but let's start off by looking at verses 12 through 17. Now those read, "Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears." Now verse 12 here is pulling directly from Isaiah 35 and 3, and that's a passage in Isaiah that is trying to provide encouragement by looking to the future coming of Christ. And that was given when the children of Israel were in a dark place and the fact that they were just on the cusp of going into captivity. And that fits in well with this passage and the idea of not being dejected. But verse 13 then instructs us to make straight paths for our feet and to remove obstacles so we don't stumble, which is reminiscent of what we talked about back in verse 1 with the idea of the race of faith. And I think this is such a good reminder for us because I think we spend a great deal of time concerned with and talking about, and appropriately so, all of the obstacles that the world is going to place in our paths. And obviously, I think most of us believe that that's only going to be increased here in this country as time goes on. But how often do the obstacles we face in our daily lives, how often are we those put there by ourselves? And I think it's always a good reminder of that, that it's so easy to get a blind spot for those things. It's so easy to just look out into the world and think, well, I need to overcome these things that the world's going to throw my way, and just spend your entire time throwing obstacles in your path. Or as I talked about in verse 1, the snare of sin, that you're the one who's putting that there. And I think that's even more true when it talks about, in verse 12, the idea of being weary. And I think when we're weary with the world, it's more easy to do that. And if we truly believe that things are going to become more difficult for us, that the world is going to place more of those obstacles in our path, well, I think it's even more wise than to focus on what we can control and focus on not putting obstacles in our own path needlessly. Moving on to verse 14. For me, when I first read this verse, I thought it seemed a little bit out of place. And I didn't quite understand why it was here in the sense that we're talking about persecution, we're talking about discipline, and yet it comes here and says, pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. But I do think it makes sense when you consider the context of what we're talking about, that really this section and really a lot of this chapter has an eye towards the apostasy, has an eye towards the pressure that they're going to experience from the world, both in terms of persecution, both in terms of struggles and strife, but also with people just simply trying to force them or change their minds and opinions back towards Judaism. And in that sense, I think so much of this chapter is talking about the interaction the world is going to have with us, and here the author makes a point to point out how we need to interact with the world. And that, I think in many ways, that makes sense here, that when the world challenges us, when the world pressures us, how are we going to respond? The best example and the best guidance for that comes from the teachings of Christ. Matthew 5, 38 and 40, I think, is a good reminder, and I'll just read that here, about what we can do when we may seek to be bitter or angry towards the world, where he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Or we can think of Christ on the cross, you know, asking for forgiveness for those who were killing him. But perhaps if we're not getting angry at those in the world, perhaps we're just withdrawing or being apathetic. But again, there's teachings from the Lord on this, from Christ, and the best example of that is the Sermon on the Mount. I'll read from Matthew 5, verses 10 through 16, which read, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you, and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all those who are in the house. Let your light shine before men that you may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. And I think this passage reminds us, and those teachings of Christ tell us that when we face persecution and pressure from the world, we should not respond with anger or bitterness, but we also shouldn't withdraw ourselves and be apathetic towards the world. And I can tell you that makes a difference as someone who spent so much, you know, of my early adult life in childhood in the world, that I remember, and I mentioned earlier that when I first came to Christ, that there were those who questioned my decisions and, you know, at times pressured me and gave me a hard time about it. But frankly, there was a time in my life where I was that person for other people that I knew. There was a time where I did not understand why people followed the Lord and that I questioned them and that I tried to throw stumbling blocks in their way. And I say that to my shame, but so many of those people responded with kindness and with patience. And when I look back on it, if they hadn't, I'm not sure if I would have had a heart that was willing to accept the Lord in the manner that I was, if that had been a stumbling block I had to deal with. And so I tell that to you in the sense that when you go out into the world, there's people who challenge you and question you and pressure you. Remember that ultimately there are souls to be won. Moving on then to verse 15, the Greek word there for fall means wanting or lacking. And looking at that phrase of root of bitterness, I think we're reminded of, and I think what this passage is really drawing out is Deuteronomy 29. I know that I'm going to shorten that passage up for the sake of time, as we don't quite have too much time to go through the whole passage there. So we'll just read verses 14 through 20. And I'll read that now. I make this covenant and this oath, not with you alone, but with him who stands here with us today before the Lord our God, as well as with him who is not here today with us. For you know that we dwelt in the land of Egypt, and that we came through the nations which you passed by. And you saw their abominations and their idols which were among you, wood and stone and silver and gold. So there may not be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turns away from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, that there may not be among you a root bearing bitterness or wormwood. And so it may not happen when he hears the words of this curse that he blesses himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, even though I follow the dictates of my heart, as though the drunkard could be included with the sober. The Lord would not spare him, for then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy would burn against that man, and every curse that is written in this book would settle on him, and the Lord would blot out his name from under heaven. Now there, the Lord warned about that root of bitterness, just like the author is here. And that warns about a person saying to themselves that they will have peace, even though they're following the dictates of their own heart. And just like with a bitter root, that's going to bring forth bitterness. Can't bring forth anything else. I think about when you try to pull a weed and you leave the root behind, that's not going to spring up anything in the future but another weed. And ultimately, that is useless. That root of bitterness can't profit anything. And even worse than not being profitable, it's dangerous. And that it says the bitterness can spread. It's like a poison. And that it can cause many to become defiled. Just like it says in the passage there from Deuteronomy, it says so here in this chapter. And that ultimately, the end for that root and the end for that type of behavior and that mindset is destruction. Now, the author then compares this to Esau, which is really an apt comparison. Because looking at Genesis 25, when Esau sells his birthright to Jacob for some stew, it says that he despised his birthright. And here he's compared to a fornicator or a profane person, someone who disregards their faith, who has bitterness and contempt for it, and just casts it aside. And that's fair, because Esau gave up something great for something temporal, really gave it up for nothing. He had the promise that the Lord had given him through the lineage of Abraham and Isaac. He had the benefit of his birthright being the firstborn, that we know as Abraham was a great man, Isaac was also, and that would have meant a great deal, being the firstborn son. And that ultimately, though, it says here that when he was hungry, he said, referring to those things, what is it to me? And just cast it aside as if it was nothing. I believe that's why the Lord permitted Jacob and Rebekah's trick to work, because he knew that he had already cast it aside. He'd already given up that birthright for nothing. And when we sin, though, when we allow that bitterness to take root, aren't we doing the exact same thing? Aren't we casting aside all of the blessings and benefits that we have? Because later on here in this passage, it refers to us as the church of the firstborn. And are we not taking the rights and the privileges as the firstborn of the Lord, and are we not casting that aside for something temporal, just like with Esau? Just like with Esau, if we're not careful, verse 17 tells us that no amount of tears will save us, just like Christ told us that there will be much weeping and gnashing of teeth for those who are told to depart from the Lord. Now, I know we'll transition here in a minute to verses 18 through 24. Again, wanted to pause for any comments or questions.
In verse 14, the ESV says, strive for peace with everyone. And I thought that was an interesting word to have with peace. As best I can tell, the word comes from a Greek word which means to press on, to pursue, as one who in a race runs swiftly to reach the goal. What that indicates to me is having a peaceful relationship with other people is not just becoming a doormat, not just a limp noodle. It is working. There's effort. You're pressing toward that goal of having peace. You're not run over by the evil, but you're working towards coming to a resolution.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that. And I think that works in well with the fact that, like we talked about, we shouldn't show apathy towards the world and we shouldn't show anger towards it, but I would agree we shouldn't just allow it to sweep over us. So appreciate that. Anyone else then before we move on? All right, well, we'll go ahead then and pick up and we'll read verses 18 through 24. For you have not come to the mountain that may be touched and that burned with fire and to blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them anymore. For they could not endure what was commanded, and if so much as a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned or shot with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I am exceedingly afraid and trembling. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. Now here we move to what is truly the climax of the entire epistle. This is the climax of the entire argument about the superiority of Christ and Christianity to basically everything else. And to drive that point home, we see the comparison between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion, the comparison of the old to the new. And then at the end of this, we do see, at the end of this kind of passage in the next part, we see a warning there about those who move past this. But this reference to Mount Sinai mainly comes from Exodus 19. I know we'll just read a part of that. I know I'll read Exodus 19, 21 through 25. And the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. But Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it. Then the Lord said to him, away, get down and come up, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. So in verse 18 of Hebrews 12, the author really here is invoking how the old law that we read about there in Exodus 19, the way that that was given to them was predicated on that spectacle that they witnessed. It was predicated really on fear. It was terror and horror as they described it. And that was what was before the people at Mount Sinai. But also touches on the idea that it was physical in nature. It says the mountain that could be touched. We know they weren't permitted to touch the mountain, but it was a physical, tangible mountain. It was a physical thing that's being referred to there. And look in the next few verses. We read about how the sound of the trumpet and the voice of God was so terrifying that they begged for it to stop, which comes from Exodus 20, 18 through 19. Verse 20 says they couldn't bear the fear and the terror of the fact that anything that touched the mountain, man or beast, would have to be killed. And in verse 21, the author goes further and says that we know that Moses and Aaron were the only ones that could approach the Lord, but even Moses said he was exceedingly afraid and trembling, which appears to be a revelation given to the author. And what we see through all of this is, again, the idea that this moment was predicated on that spectacle, predicated on the physical, on fear, and fear of punishment, fear of the Lord. And wasn't that the old law, though? Doesn't that sum up so much of the old law that they had to deal with? The physical, the fear, the prohibition, and ultimately punishment. And the people couldn't deal with that. It reminds me again of the allusion to parenting we've talked about, that so much of raising a young child is about discipline and prohibition and trying to get them to listen. But eventually you move past that. You move to a point of a deeper and fuller relationship. You move to a place where you start are able to move beyond that to things that are more important. And that's the same as with God and his people, if we compare then to now. And that's what the author brings forth in verses 22 through 24. The superiority of Christ and Christianity and our relationship with the Lord through Christ. That superior here is borne out by showing that we now come to Mount Zion, not physically, as they were brought to a physical mountain that they couldn't touch, but we are brought from the gospel of Christ to Mount Zion, as it says, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly, the church of the firstborn who registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, to the blood of the sprinkling which speaks better things than that of Abel. And comparing those two things, what comparison is there? How could you compare that to what they faced at Mount Sinai? To the darkness and the tempest and the fire and the blackness, the things that horrified them and that they were so afraid of that they begged for it to stop. And what ultimately became one of the sites of their greatest failures with the golden calf, where that fear overwhelmed them and took them to a place of sin. And we see this advantage further if we break down this description of Mount Zion. In verse 23, that Greek word for general assembly, that's singular in usage in the New Testament to this spot, and from what I read in my studies, it may appear at first to be a separate thing from the church and a separate thing from the company of angels, but from what I read in the original Greek, it would have been made more clear that this is referring to the assembly of angels. But regardless, you think about the fact that the Lord took the children of Israel to Mount Sinai to have them be alone, to put them on their own in the wilderness, And that's what they had to then face the Lord there at Mount Sinai. They had to do that alone. But yet, we come to Mount Zion with this innumerable company of angels. Verse 23 refers to us as the church of the firstborn, recalling back to Esau being the firstborn and everything that came with it, the inheritance that we have. And it says here that we are registered with those. And that would have meant to be enrolled in the Greek, the idea that that is where your citizenship is placed, and that you have those who are mentioned in chapter 11 who are already in heaven, the spirits of just men made perfect, and we are now enrolled with them. We are added to that list. And looking at verses 23 and 24, that we are now, we have God, we are with, the judge of all. But now we have an advocate, a mediator in Christ Jesus. And what an incredible advantage that is. Whereas before, when we sinned, we had no way to approach the Lord. But now we have the fact that our prayers can flow through Christ Jesus to the Lord, to our judge. I have taken part in dozens of mediations in my career in insurance on all sorts of lawsuits. And one of the things that always bears true is the fact that a mediator can make all the difference because of the fact that when you have an individual who has harmed someone else, how can they approach that person? I've sat in rooms with people who have, because of their negligence, caused indescribable harm to another person in that room with them, that they have in many ways, from the other person's perspective, ruined their lives. That's what they would tell you, that this person ruined my life, that they are now, their physical body might be in a place where it just wasn't what it was before, that they had to suffer horrible injuries and permanent disability with people who have caused the death of loved ones for that person. And how could the person who caused that harm possibly approach that person to bridge that gap, to make it right? But that's what the mediator is for. The mediator is there to allow that message to flow to them. And that's exactly what we are talking about here with Christ, that we have without Christ no way to speak to the Lord when we sin against him. We lack that ability. But through Christ, our message can be carried directly to him. And furthermore, that we're told that through Christ, we have the blood of the sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. There's some debate about what this means, but I believe this is referring to the fact that when Cain killed Abel, that the blood of Abel spoke to the Lord, and through that, vengeance was delivered. But through the blood of Christ, his blood requests and calls out to the Lord for mercy for sinners. So thus now we can approach him, our Father and our judge, by faith, making supplication and receive forgiveness of our sins and receive and know that we are justified. And what greater advantage is there than that? What greater thing could we ask for and hope for than that? But with us being Hebrews, as I talked about when I first did the introduction, there's always going to be a warning and there's going to be an exhortation. Verses 25 through 29 read, "See that you do not refuse him who speaks. For if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now is promised, saying, yet once more I shall shake not only the earth, but also heaven. Now this, yet once more, indicates the removal of those things which are being shaken, and of the things that are made. The things which cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace, by which we may serve acceptably, with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire." Now here in verse 25, Moses is compared with the Lord in the fact that Moses delivered the law while here on earth, but we receive from our Father the word that's spoken from him in heaven. Verse 26 then quotes Haggai 2 and 6 with a prophecy referencing the coming of Christ and how it's comparing here the fact that when they went to Mount Sinai, that the mountain shook and the ground around it, but rather with Christ, all things have been shaken. All things have been touched by that event. But verse 27 then really sums up, I think, perfectly what he is trying to get them to see. Because here the author shows that everything from the Jewish faith that was solid, that was true, remains after it was touched, after it was shaken by the gospel of Christ. The teachings that we are to stand on, the lessons about the nature of the Lord, all of that remains, but everything else, that is gone. Everything that was just a type and a shadow of what was to come has been done away with. And that which is true remains and therefore cannot be shaken until Christ comes again. So verses 28 and 29 make it clear that if this is what you are receiving, what choice do you have? The choice is between a religion that no longer exists, that has been done away with, that has been shaken and has collapsed and is gone. The decision is between that and what remains and will remain until Christ comes again. But ultimately, there is a warning here at the very end. And I think this warning calls back to all of those descriptions of Mount Sinai. The God that frightened them so much that they were scared to hear his voice. That is the same God now. It's the same God that he's always been and always will be. And that we know that the choice and ultimately what you will have to deal with if you refuse this advantage is his punishment. Because as it says here, he is a consuming fire. Now the children are coming up, but I know with the last few seconds we have, are there any comments or anything anyone would like to add?